I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest, Matt Den, was insurance commissioner and lieutenant governor of Delaware before being elected attorney general this past November. He was sworn in earlier this month and said at the ceremony, it's time to get things done. He wants to put more police on the streets in Wilmington that has experienced a violent crime wave in recent months. In fact, there were 7 shootings this past weekend that left 2 teenagers dead. A 26-year-old was shot and killed yesterday afternoon. The 11th shooting this year and the 6th fatality. Den also wants to increase the penalties for crimes committed with a gun and address the crisis of addiction in the first state. He established a civil rights office on his second day on the job. Matt Den drove up from Wilmington, Delaware to join us today on Radio Times, and thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So you were lieutenant governor. You became the attorney general. Why didn't you want to stay lieutenant governor?
I loved being lieutenant governor. It was actually a very, very difficult decision to make, and it had to be made very quickly. Our last attorney general, Beau Biden, announced that he wasn't going to seek reelection in April. In fact, I can remember very specifically when it was, because it was the Friday before the Easter weekend, and it was generally accepted that anyone who wanted to run for that office probably needed to make up their mind within 72 hours or so, because it's an office that a lot of people were going to want to run for. So it was a tough decision for me, because I loved being lieutenant governor. It's before this job was the best job that I ever had, and I really was very pleased with some of the things that we were doing. But I talked to my wife and a few other folks, and what really decided it for me was that, as you mentioned, we've had a very bad month in terms of violent crime in the state, but it's certainly not new, and it's been a persistent problem over the last few years. And I know these neighborhoods pretty well, that where a lot of the violent crime is taking place. When I came back to Delaware after law school to work, I was working for Delaware Volunteer Legal Services for a couple years, working in the basements of a lot of the churches and shelters that are in these communities where this violence is going on. So I know the neighborhoods very well. I know a lot of the people very well. And it's just – to me, it's just a compelling problem. So I ran for the office because I wanted to see if I could take a crack at dealing with it.
Well, Wilmington, like a lot of cities – so you're a smaller city, obviously, than Philadelphia – having a problem of violent crime. It looks like crimes committed with firearms. Is there something unique about Wilmington, or do you think what is happening in Wilmington, it just represents what's happening in a lot of cities?
Well, I think that what is different about what's happening in Wilmington is that statistically, at least, we are seeing improvements in a lot of states and even in a lot of urban areas around the country. And we're not seeing that improvement in Wilmington. So the bad news is that the numbers are not good. The good news is that we have persistently seen that states and cities that do the right things are able to get things going in the right direction. And that's been true over decades. I mean, the classic example that everybody looks at is New York City, which, you know, a couple decades ago had a really out-of-control violent crime problem and did some pretty smart things, and now is considered one of the safest cities in the country.
I'm looking at a Newsweek article. It goes back to the end of 2014. Murdertown, USA, also known as Wilmington, Delaware. Fair? Not fair?
Well, the numbers are the numbers. You know, the reality is that our homicide numbers and violent crimes generally with firearm numbers have been bad for a couple of years. They've been steadily bad at the same time that numbers have been getting better around the rest of the country. So that was not the first article that we had seen that was comparing Wilmington to other cities, both large cities and small cities. And when everyone else is getting better and you're not, then you do start to see articles that unfavorably compare you to other states. It's it's a human tragedy, obviously. And, you know, one of the things that I try to contact all of the victims' families of these homicides. I'm not successful in every case, but I at least try. And I've gotten to speak to most of them, and it really it's the right thing to do anyway, but it certainly leaves a pretty searing impression on you in terms of the human impact on the families. But you mentioned the article. The other sort of broad-scale impact that it has is that we are, like every other state, trying to come back from the worst recession in 75 years. And when you're seeing articles like that about your state, and in particular your center of commerce,
sure.
it makes it incredibly difficult to attract new businesses and to hold on to the businesses we have.
So are there things that New York has done that you think Wilmington should use or do in that city, in your city?
Oh, absolutely. And there are, you know, the challenge with New York and other cities that have had success is that they did lots of things. And, you know, people a lot smarter than me teach college courses trying to pick apart what was the one thing or the two things that were most successful. So, you know, one thing that appears to be consistent from the New York City example to other areas that have had success is having very visible foot patrol law enforcement presences that are very specifically directed at the high crime areas. Most of the violent crime that's happening in our city is happening in some pretty discreet areas, and it's a small city.
Mm-hmm.
It is a manageable challenge to be able to have more foot patrols in these areas, and yet for the last several years we haven't had that. So that's not a panacea. But at a minimum, it's a necessary element of dealing with the problem and looking at the other examples. So that was one of our first orders of business, was to try to go about making that happen.
So how many foot patrols, and where would you get the money?
Well, when we started out, our proposal was to start with six officers, 6 p.m. to 1 a.m., Monday through Sunday, starting at the beginning of March, going through the end of the summer. And the reason that we picked that number was not because we thought that was sufficient, but because we were able to actually identify some grant funds that we could apply for that would pay for that. That's obviously always the challenge, is how are you going to pay for the additional officers. So we put together, with the cooperation of the city, a proposal to pay for overtime. It would go first preference to Wilmington police officers, and if there weren't enough, then we would have Newcastle County and Delaware State Troopers come in to fill the gap. And that would start at the beginning of March, go for 6 months, and then we would reassess, and if it's working, we would try to extend it. Six officers may not sound like a lot, but that article that you just mentioned had some statements from the Wilmington Police Department to the effect that most nights currently they only have about 6 to 9 officers on patrol.
So, for the whole city?
Correct. That's not my number. That's from the police department. So six additional officers is a significant increase. Now, having said that, just a couple days ago, the city announced that it was going to try to increase on its own the foot patrols in some of these areas. So that was just announced a couple days ago, and we don't really know the details of that. But obviously, that would be a positive development as well.
Is that a police department decision, though, or is that an attorney general decision about whether to put more cops on the street, how to deploy them, in a sense, how to pay them as well?
Well, this proposal is something that we put together jointly with the police department. And your question's a good one, because at the end of the day, the city police department has to be in charge of who goes where. But we are co-seeking the money with them. They're going to make the overtime available to their officers first. They're going to meet collaboratively with us, the county police, and the state police on a weekly basis to look at which neighborhoods the officers should go to and make some sort of tactical decisions. So at the end of the day, the city police department has to make those final decisions, but they have been very agreeable to doing that in a collaborative way, because they, more than anyone, they want to see the problem solved, and they've been very receptive to getting help in solving it.
Is this hotspot policing? I mean, for instance, here in Philadelphia, they're looking at certain, or they've also deployed more police officers, even more of law enforcement, generally speaking, to certain parts of the city to focus on what ends up being kind of a handful of people responsible for a lot of the violent crime.
Yeah, hotspot is one shorthand that I've heard for. They call it different things in different places, but that's generally the idea. And it's a very it's not an overly complicated idea, that you would send more officers in a very visible way to the places where bad things are happening. Sometimes people move from place to place, so it's important to stay on top of where the activity is happening and move your officers accordingly. And then there are some good and bad practices in terms of what you do when you're there and how you interact with people who live in the community, with people who are in the community who maybe should not be there. And we're going to try to be smart about how we implement this as well.
And that's really referencing the police-community relationship. And that has been so much in the spotlight as a result of Ferguson and some other events across the country, making sure that they are on the same team, in a sense.
On both ends. I mean, you want to have good relationships between the officers and the residents who live in the community because you're relying on them to help you in terms of identifying people who shouldn't be there. If something does happen, being willing to talk to officers about it. But also in terms of your interaction with people who aren't part of the neighborhood, it's important that the officers know what is okay, what's not okay. And I think our officers are well-trained and that they will do well with that. But when you are sending officers into, by definition, the most dangerous neighborhoods in the community, you want to make sure that everyone is prepared to make sure that the outcome is a good one.
As we know, Wilmington, a headquarter for a lot of Fortune 500 companies. I mean, do you see it in a way as almost like two cities? You've got part of the city that is really grappling with some serious violent crimes, but you've got the other part of the city that's kind of flush and enjoying the economy.
Well, it's a small city, so you know that may technically be true, but you know those two parts of the city are a 2 or 3 minute drive from each other. My dad lives in New York City, and he was coming down for my swearing in, and we decided purposefully to do my swearing in one of the neighborhoods that has seen a lot of criminal activity at a police athletic league center. And my dad emailed me that he was going to he doesn't have a car because he lives in New York City.
Right.
So they were going to come down and stay at a hotel in downtown Wilmington and that he would make his way over to the swearing in and that he had looked on Google Maps or something and that it looked like it was just a mile away and he thought that they might just walk over. And I emailed him back that, you know, maybe take a cab. So it's – I mean, you're right that these things are happening in discrete areas, but – A, it's a small city, and B, you know, we have seen that the activity can move pretty quickly. A lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is drug related. And as the drug traffic moves, then the violent activity can move as well.
Well, I'm thinking about the traffic on 95. I mean, the fact that I-95 in many ways bisects the city, is that part of the problem if we're talking about drugs going sort of up and down the East Coast?
That's been a persistent problem. I mean, one of the most notorious cases that we had over the last year was in at a corner grocery store that is literally a block off of the I-95 exit, and a woman in her mid-40s went to the grocery store just to buy some food, came out and was caught in the crossfire of a gunfight between two organizations that were sort of fighting for turf that included that corner, and the belief is that it was drug related, and because it's right off of 95, it's easy on, easy off in terms of people who want to be doing drug trafficking. So that it certainly doesn't help.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Matt Den is our guest. He became earlier this month Delaware's 45th Attorney General. He has served as Lieutenant Governor of Delaware. In fact, in a sense, quit that job to be the Attorney General or to run for Attorney General. And he did obviously win in November. He also was the Insurance Commissioner for the first state. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We got a lot of comments on our social media here. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you live, work in Delaware. We want to hear from you. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Matt Den. He's Delaware's new attorney general. We've been talking a lot about the problem of violent crime in sections of Wilmington, Delaware. We're going to also be talking about some of the other ideas and plans he has as the new attorney general of the first state. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And again, I'll be reading some social email comments as well. You want to increase the penalties for crimes committed with a gun. Do I have that right?
Yes. One of the things that I did before I took office, I had about 7 weeks, and I tried to meet everybody in the office face-to-face. There are about 400 people who work in the office, half of them attorneys. And as I was meeting with the prosecutors, I asked them what are the where are our gaps in terms of our ability to enforce. Delaware is different from Pennsylvania. We don't have district attorneys in Delaware, so every criminal case is prosecuted through the state attorney general's office. And one area that they identified for me is that we have people who are prohibited from having firearms because of prior violent felony convictions. if they committed those violent felonies as adults and then they carry a firearm, they get a minimum mandatory jail sentence. If they committed those violent felonies when they were 16 or 17 years old and they're a person prohibited, then they don't get minimum mandatory time and, in fact, in most cases get probation. And what we are seeing is that a lot of our – to the extent that we actually get suspects and convictions in these cases, that a lot of our shooters are people who are young adults who have had long interactions with the criminal justice system, have committed violent offenses as teenagers. So one fairly narrow suggestion that we made to the legislature is we need to be able to tell 20-year-olds, 22-year-olds that if you're a person prohibited from having a firearm because of a violent felony when you were 17, then you're going to get mandatory time for that.
And, the basic, treated like an adult, I mean,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, and the basic idea is that we cannot have people who have violent felony histories walking around on our streets with firearms, and we need to be able to make them know that there are consequences to that, and to the extent that they don't care if there are consequences, not have them out walking around with guns.
Does that question then the juvenile justice system, which sort of philosophically believes that if you're a teenager, you commit a crime, that was a youthful indiscretion, if I can say, and you get to start over as an adult? Sounds like you're pushing back on that.
It's a great question for two reasons. One is these people are adults. I mean, we're talking now about people who are adults. They're prohibited from having a firearm because of a violent felony that they committed as a juvenile, but they are now adults and have not only made a conscious decision to carry a firearm anyway, but have probably had to go to extraordinary lengths to get the firearm, because we have a pretty thorough registry law in Delaware. You can't – if you're 21 years old and you had a violent felony when you were 17, you can't walk into a gun store and buy a firearm. So these are – if you have a gun and you're prohibited because of a 17-year-old violent felony, you had to have gone to some effort to illegally get that gun. So we feel comfortable that these are people who have guns for the wrong reasons. When you mentioned the juvenile system, though, I think that the succinct answer to your question is yes. I am pushing back a little bit on the idea that 16 and 17-year-olds in particular who are committing adult crimes with firearms ought to be treated in a dramatically different way. They are juveniles. It is a different system. But you mentioned the incidents that we had this weekend. We have a lot of not just 16 and 17-year-olds but 14 and 15-year-olds walking around with guns who are members of gang-affiliated organizations, and it is a different situation out on the streets now than it was when I was 17 years old. And so I think that we need to adjust our thinking at least somewhat to reflect the fact that a lot of this activity is happening from 16 and 17-year-olds.
We have an email from Gary sort of picking up on what you just said. Are there any numbers indicating what's motivating these crimes? Drugs, poverty, organized gang activity? Are there any facts showing crimes being committed by non-residents in Wilmington, for instance?
I'm 3 weeks on the job as of yesterday. Unfortunately, that has already given me a little bit of a template to work with, and I think that we have seen some of everything. We don't have a lot of arrests yet, unfortunately, from the violence that we've had since I took office. So I can't talk a lot, but just based on what I know about the investigations, some of it's drug related. Mm-hmm. Some of it has to do with young people walking around with guns and incidents that, when I was a teenager, might have resulted in a shoving match, now resulting in gun violence. And also, a fair amount of it is not occurring in Wilmington. We've certainly had a bad month in Wilmington, but I think that probably, if I'm having to add the numbers in my head, I think the majority of the homicides that we have had since I took office have been outside the city. And a lot of that, again, it's, you know, some of the cases aren't resolved yet, but a lot of that is drug related, and it is tied to the fact that we have, as so many states do, a very serious substance use disorder problem. And as long as there are people who are eager to be able to purchase heroin and other drugs, then people will be selling it, and there are both property crime and violent crime that tends to follow that.
And I do want to pick up on that and talk about heroin, but let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Ken from Wilmington, Delaware, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? First of all, congratulations to you. I'm a North Wilmington resident. I've been here since 1980. My question is very simple. Has there ever been consideration to condense the police department like they did in Camden, where they just eliminated the Camden police force, and the county actually now basically patrols the whole county? I'll hang up on that. And again, congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken, for the call. Go ahead, Matt Dent.
There have been very public conversations about whether the city and the county police forces in Delaware should be combined in some way. And I've heard legislators talk about it. I've heard the members of the judiciary talk about it. Our newspapers have written about it. So it's been a topic of open conversation. My priority, that if that were ever to happen, that is a very complex undertaking. To say the least. So, you know, I have an immediate problem on my hands, which is that people are shooting each other in unacceptable numbers. So, I'm focused right now on trying to do things that are, if not within my control, at least that I can get people to coalesce around in a fairly rapid fashion. So, the good news is that the county and the state are working very collaboratively with us, not just on this foot patrol project that I mentioned, but also on some of the other areas that we're trying to work on.
Ken, thanks for the call. Looks like we have Ethan from Kennett Square joining us on Radio Times. And Ethan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I worked for 10 years ago in Wilmington in those same neighborhoods, the same basements and the same kinds of places where even then it was a very serious, a serious mess. That's a complicated problem that I think certainly goes back to the time when ethnic neighborhoods emptied themselves so people could avoid living with immigrating black families. But one of the things that was very clear to me was that the pathway into the violence and the drug dealing is much smoother, and there isn't a point at which somebody says, as a child, as a kid, I think I'll sign on the line and get my gun and become a dealer and take up violence. That young people that I worked with would hold $5 for the dealer, and you know they'd be given $5 to spend on food at the corner store, and in exchange they'd sort of holler when the police came. So that it was very, very easy to go from just being a resident and being, as all of those kids are, good kids, to being a person with a gun on the street corner. And so the balance between law enforcement and then making every effort in the world to interrupt that pathway, to make sure that it's much harder to become a drug dealer than it is to get a job or to stay in school or to have dreams and hopes and plans.
Well, Ethan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Matt Dent, there are these people called interrupters. I mean, and these are often community organizers or people who know a community well, and they intervene to try to prevent some of the conflicts that you described that can end up in shootings.
And I think your caller, you know, one of the other points that I think he was trying to make is that, you know, you have to get to these young people early and provide them with, you know, an alternative view of the world. And one of the other very important things that we're trying to work on is we've, as a state, we have about $36 million that we just received in settlement funds from one of these settlements that we made with national banks that had engaged in bad practices in the financial markets. So we have $36 million in income that's come into the state. And we've made a very specific proposal about trying to use that money to actually address some of these issues. We've proposed spending about $5 million of it to send new teachers and paraprofessionals into some of our high poverty school, elementary schools in the state to expand after school programs and summer programs for juveniles, expand substance abuse treatment facilities, reentry programs for inmates that are coming out of our correctional facilities. So, I mean, to your caller's point, you know, we are trying to recognize the fact that it's not – foot patrols is, I think, necessary but not sufficient. And if you're not getting to these kids and these teenagers and trying to provide them with some opportunities and alternatives, then you're not going to have the outcomes you want.
Ethan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you get to decide about how this money is spent, this $36 million?
Most legal settlements, the Attorney General's office decides. This one involved so much money. For a state Delaware size, $36 million is a lot of money. We thought that it was important that we work with the governor's office and work with the General Assembly. So the governor's signed off on the plan, but a week from tomorrow, we're going down to the General Assembly's Joint Finance Committee, and we're going to try to persuade them that this is the way to spend the money as well. And it's, you know, that's going to be trying to convince people that your way of spending $36 million is the right way is a challenge. But the good news is that there's been a ton of community support for our proposal from clergy, educators, from the substance abuse treatment community. So I'm hopeful that they will sign off next week.
You mentioned heroin, and a number of states, cities are dealing with a problem of heroin addiction and all the other problems that go along with that. Is the approach a law enforcement approach? Is it a treatment approach, some combination of the two from your perspective?
It's a combination of those two, and then on top of that, education, and in our state's case at least, and I think Pennsylvania is right there with us, the fact that we have a very, very high rate of opioid prescription that tends in some cases to be a gateway into heroin. I was at a shiva at a house for a woman whose daughter had been in a car accident, got rear-ended, was treated with opioids for back pain, prescription ran out, started using heroin, didn't really know how to dose it because she had never used illegal drugs before, overdosed and died on her mother's bathroom floor. So we need to – and there have been some efforts that have been made to deal with the prescription challenge and the fact that doctors in Delaware are prescribing them at such a high rate. But we need to revisit that because we – and again, Pennsylvania is right up there with us – are still – prescribing them at a much higher rate than the rest of the country. But to your question, the treatment is a critical part of it. And with folks who have a substance use disorder, there is often a very narrow window of time when they are willing to say, I have a problem, I want to get treated. And if there's not a facility that is suited to their particular situation that's somewhere near where they live, you may miss the window when you can actually treat that person. So to the governor's great credit, he just unveiled part of his budget on Monday, and he's proposing an expansion in substance abuse treatment that I think is probably easily the largest in the history of the state. And then we're proposing to spend some of the settlement money to build on that. So I think there's an opportunity for us to really do a much better job in that front, which will pay off both in terms of the human tragedy of people who suffer from addiction, but also again in terms of reducing the demand for some of the illegal drug sale.
So if I lived in southern Delaware and needed treatment, is there something close by?
There will be. That's a substantial part of his proposal, is that that's been a real challenge, is that if for people who live downstate, that there hasn't been enough that's geographically sensible.
And that's Matt Den, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He is Delaware's new attorney general. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Ciro from looks like Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Ciro, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Recommendation. Decriminalize the use of drugs and change drug use to a medical problem. The government admits the drugs to all addicts and will help to cure all their addictions. Drug deals go out of business because why start searching for new customers? Because when he becomes an addict, he goes to the government and he doesn't need the drug dealer.
Well, Cyril, fair enough. And I mean, it is interesting, Matt Den, that a number of, for instance, in Philadelphia, the district attorney has, in a sense, helped to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. You know, I don't know if that opens the door to what Cyril is talking about, but there seems to be a shift on looking at certain kinds of drugs or certain kinds of drug possession.
Yeah, and I've said that I'm, when it comes to small amounts of marijuana for personal use, that I'm open to the idea of treating those as civil violations rather than criminal. But for me, that's about as far as it makes sense to go. And I have 10-year-old twins, and I want them to know that using drugs is something that they shouldn't do. And I'm people say, well, if it's against the law, there's a stigma attached to it, and I think that's okay. Mm. I mean, I would like young people to know that this is not something that they should be getting into. So, for me, that narrow issue of small quantities of marijuana, not having people drawn into the criminal justice system, I think that is that's an area that's okay to explore. But I've just seen the consequences of people who do become addicted too often, and what it does to their lives, and I'm just very reluctant to go down the road of exposing more people to that.
I was interested to read that Delaware had one of the first drug courts in the country, and now I think there's something almost like 3,000 drug courts in the country, but Delaware was among the first.
Yeah, and I think that our judiciary has been sensitive to the fact that those drug courts are primarily focused on people who have possession offenses versus dealing offenses, and that in many cases those are people for whom there are going to be better outcomes if they can be sent into treatment opportunities rather than the criminal justice system. One of the other benefits of us expanding available treatment options is that there actually will be treatment options for those judges to send people to. That's been one of the real challenges with the drug courts, is that if there aren't beds, then you know, then they have a cap in terms of how effective they can be.
Picking up what you said earlier, I mean, are you arguing that the war on drugs has been successful, or we just haven't waged that war correctly? Because, as you know, there's a lot of pushback on it now, feeling we filled our prisons, we haven't necessarily cut down on drugs, and we've seen certain neighborhoods explode with violence because of drugs.
Well, I mean, I don't think any reasonable person could say we've won the war on drugs, given what's in front of us and what's going on. I don't know that the solution to that is to say that it should that everything should be legal. I think that a more nuanced approach is called for, where you do recognize that there is a difference between drug dealers and drug users, where you do recognize that the appropriate way to deal with someone who is a user is not necessarily by putting them into a situation where they're going to be incarcerated for long periods of time, where you do create the capacity to actually treat people who you say that you want to treat. So I think that if we have recognized – for me, what we've – the lesson is that it's not a sort of simple, you know, linear solution.
We're almost up in a break here. I remember talking to Governor Markell about Delaware and the fact that it's – you are a small state. The first state and a small state. Is it sometimes it's easier to get things done because you are smaller, certainly than Pennsylvania? I think there's some truth to that.
It can make it easier and it can make it harder. Sometimes, you know, close quarters makes things easier to get done, and sometimes a little elbow room's not a bad thing. But I love the state. I mean, like the governor, I came back to Delaware after having been away from school, and I think, you know, for both him and for me, a lot of the reason that we chose to do what we do is that, you know, we grew up there and just feel a very deep, you know, personal attachment to the state.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Delaware's new attorney general, and his name is Matt Den. Previously, he served as lieutenant governor under the current governor, Jack Markell, and he was the insurance commissioner for the first state. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, get some more callers in, and also lots of email comments and some tweets as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Matt Den. He was the insurance commissioner for Delaware, also lieutenant governor of Delaware. And he was just elected a couple months ago in November, the attorney general of Delaware. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about some of the challenges that he faces as the new attorney general in Delaware and some of his ideas to address things like crime and also the problem of drug addiction. We are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, especially want to hear from people who live and or work in Delaware. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. An email from Bernie. He says, do you have plans to do civil forfeiture in Delaware, which are used to seize property from people who have not been convicted of a crime? And actually, there was a court ruling recently on civil forfeiture. Where does Delaware stand on that?
It's happened in Delaware. It's happened in all 50 states throughout. Our plan is to continue doing it as it has happened. I mean, it's as your listener points out, it's something that you have to be careful with because these are people who haven't been through the criminal justice system, and the federal government very, very recently, within the last week or so, indicated that it was going to scale back on the amount of forfeiture activity that it did. So it's actually the federal government's decision has caused us to have to step back and reevaluate how we're going to do it. But the short answer is it's been done before. It'll continue to be done, but it needs to be done in a way that is, you know, respectful of the fact that the criminal justice system hasn't run its course.
Well, and it was originally intended to go after some of these big drug dealers, right? And then has been used for lesser crimes and questions raised about whether the money or the assets seized were used to pay for police and things like that.
Yeah, it has to be done carefully. I mean, one of the lessons that, you know, even in the first week, it's not a lesson because I anticipated it coming into the office, but, you know, prosecutors' offices, and in particular an office like the Delaware Attorney General's office that has this statewide criminal jurisdiction, it is a huge responsibility that has to be handled very carefully because whether it's through civil forfeiture or through what the office decides to investigate or how it decides to investigate something, it can be enormously disruptive to people's lives. So it's very important that that the powers of the office be used responsibly. I think our folks do, but it's one of the things I've been very impressed with coming in is how careful and thoughtful people who wield that type of discretion and authority have to be.
One of the perhaps the first thing that you did when you became officially the Attorney General sworn in was to establish a civil rights office. Why was that such a big priority for you?
Well, we have because civil rights are a big priority for me, and we have in our state, as many states do, a whole umbrella of state civil rights laws, housing, public accommodations, employment discrimination, discrimination against people with disabilities. And in some respects, our state laws are different and broader than federal laws are, particularly as it relates to gender identity and to LGBT rights. So it was important to me that there be a person and a part of the office that had specific responsibility for enforcing those laws, because absent that, if there's not someone in the office who's responsible for enforcement, then those tend to be laws that aren't as vigorously enforced. So it was important to me that there be someone who was responsible, that there be a place that people knew that they could go to. And we actually have called it the Office of Civil Rights and Public Trust, because there's also another part to it that involves people who are in places of public trust in government, and there being some accountability on our part to make sure that the laws that govern them are also enforced.
I mean, things like campaign finance or just sort of how people behave while they're in office and elective office.
Both. And also our state auditor's office that deals with, financial propriety of what goes on with state monies. That's another part of that office that we want to be working more closely with.
Let me get Carol from Wilmington to join us. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
thanks
there
for taking my call.
You're
and
welcome
the privilege of talking to our Attorney General.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to ask this question. Why do you care, Attorney General, about the violence in Wilmington? And the reason why I ask that question is every time I hear a conversation around the violence that's happening, it's around corporations leaving the city or our image, Murder Town, USA, being out there, and not about the fact that young, poor, Hispanic, black, white young men are dying on our streets every day. Communities are affected. Not only are those who are shot affected, but those who are shooting are affected. So my thing is, if the reason why you care is about these communities, about these young men, then the solutions will be better long-term solutions that can affect these communities and not just affect the numbers. So my question is, why do you care?
Interesting, Carol. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Matt Dan.
I mean, I think that the short answer is it goes back to what you asked me about at the beginning of the show of why I ran for this in the first place. I know these communities pretty well. I spent the first couple of years of my career in Delaware after law school working in these communities. I would go to a church at the corner of 29th and Market Street, 26th, I should say, and Union Street, and I'd spend 2 hours there on a Thursday night, and people would come in with their legal problems, and I would try to deal with them. So 2 years of being in churches in these communities, a couple hours a night, and you get to know the neighborhoods pretty well, and you get to know the communities pretty well, and you get to care about what happens to those communities pretty well. And I've never really lost touch with those communities. So what motivated me to run for this office in the first place was that I care very deeply about what happens to those communities. And as I said, it was not an easy decision to run for this office, because I was halfway through a second term as lieutenant governor and doing what I thought were some very important things in terms of advocating for kids and students in public schools. So it's not something that I chose to do lightly, and the motivation really was, the degree to which I care about what happens in these communities.
And what I heard in Carol's question was, people might say they're concerned about the crime rate in Wilmington, but they're worried about the image of the city and whether it's going to drive middle-class people or perhaps even companies out of the city.
And you don't have to choose. I mean, you can be worried about both. And I think we should be worried about both. You can care very deeply, as I do, about what's happening to people who live in these neighborhoods, and also care a great deal about what it means, in a larger sense for the state over the long run. And I think it's important to send both messages out, because, Wilmington is our biggest city, but it still has only a minority of the total state population living there. And it's important for us to communicate to everyone throughout the entire state that they need to care about what happens in Wilmington that they need to invest in Wilmington and contribute to solving the problem.
I was reading that Wilmington, I think about 58% of the residents are African American. The police force, about 20% are African American. Does that need to be adjusted, do you think, when it comes to the police force? Does that matter, the race of a police officer?
My interaction with all three of our police departments that are working in the city, the state, the county, and the city police department, has been that their relations with the community are good. They can always be better, and I think ideally you like to have your police force reflect the community that it is serving. But it's something that I think that the departments have been conscientious about trying to work on with the officers, and I think that's part of the reason that we have not seen some of the problems that have arisen in other communities around the country.
Let me see what Brooke from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. Brooke, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I come from a community that has a pretty strong tradition of solving all their issues with neighbors and then letting people do what they do. This makes it kind of difficult, actually, because they don't necessarily report things to any authority if they see something suspicious or even if they see something outright illegal. Is there anything that the Attorney General's office or the state in general is doing to help try to bring neighborhoods like this into the habit of relying on the police a little more?
Well, Brooke, it's an interesting question. Go ahead, Matt.
That's a great question. And that's, part of the benefit of these foot patrols is ideally that you do begin to have those personal relationships develop between the residents and the police. We actually, in the Attorney General's office, have something called a Crime Strategies Unit, which in large part involves prosecutors who actually go to neighborhood association and civic association meetings and try to establish those types of relationships with trust with the residents who attend those meetings, again, for the same purpose of having that ability to have dialogue with them. But absolutely one of the challenge in terms of solving these homicides when they happen is the reluctance of people to come forward. And mm-hmm. to some degree it's understandable because there's a lot of violence going on and some people are afraid. So it makes that much more important that there be a relationship of trust both with police and with prosecutors.
Brooke, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you a little bit about the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner was, fired? Let go? I'm not sure exactly what the word is. And there is a new medical examiner, a guy named Gary Collins. What's up with the medical examiner's office in Delaware?
Well, there were a lot of well-documented problems with the office. I can't talk too much about what was passed because it's the subject of a pending investigation. But in terms of going forward, I think there's a pretty good consensus that things are much improved and that handling of evidence and preservation of evidence and the integrity of the evidence gathering process is where it ought to be. We're still dealing with the after effects of it in terms of there have been a number of challenges to convictions and the like that arose from problems that were revealed.
Do you know why Bo Biden didn't run? It wasn't interested in running for Attorney General again in the state of Delaware.
Well, there seems to
be some mystery about that, and I don't know if you can solve that for
us. He's told me the same thing that he said publicly, which is that he intends to run for governor in 2016 and that he felt that it was important, given that he had made that decision, that he dedicate himself to doing that. And he's continued to say that since then, both publicly and again in other conversations that he's had with me.
Let me see what Joe from Delaware City has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Joe.
Congratulations.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Marty. Congratulations, Matt.
Thanks.
My question is, I can certainly appreciate all this concern for our violent crime. It's a big concern. But my question is, does your office or you have any plans to make some inroads into how crowded our prisons are with nonviolent offenders? Thank you.
Sure, Joe. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, we're going to be introducing some legislation later in the legislative session that will propose to adjust some of our sentencing laws very specifically to reflect the fact that some nonviolent, primarily drug possession offenses ought to have sentences that are less in terms of duration than they are now. I don't know ultimately how many people that actually will affect and what the impact on the prison bed count will be. But I think there's a growing consensus that very, very long sentences for basic drug possession convictions are probably something that needs to be revisited.
Because they're counterproductive or they're expensive?
Both.
Both. I don't know if you've referenced this or not, but I know Governor Markell has the Public Safety Strategies Commission. They're going to issue some kind of a report at the end of March. You get to select a member. Perhaps you already have.
I have.
You have?
Yes.
And this is what, to come up with some ideas for dealing with some of what we've been talking about?
I think the basic idea is that we want to make sure that the Wilmington Police Department and the City of Wilmington get the best possible advice about how best to organize and to to deal strategically and tactically with the problem that they are faced with, and to try to get both around the table within the state and also bring in from outside the state folks to give the best possible advice, and to do it on a pretty quick time frame. And the city's been very receptive to that, because again, I think that the mayor and the police department, I think they, as much as anybody, want to see the problem dealt with.
And that's Matt Den. He is the new Attorney General for Delaware, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Jennifer from, looks like, Newark, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, when Beau Biden took over as Attorney General, he came in, real strong and was going to fight, be our Batman, fight crime. And as the years went down and his tenure kind of went, came to a close, he kind of got, I know he's focusing on becoming the next governor, but it's like, you need to do your job there,
And Jennifer, your question is, I'm looking at the clock here.
I mean, I worked in a area of Wilmington that was very, crime-ridden, and when I went to work, I was locked down. Basically, it was on Vandiver Avenue. It was a printing company, and Mr. Den knows.
Sure.
I just wanted to make sure that he's going to be much stronger than, through his tenure than Mr. Biden was.
Sure, fair enough. Thanks, Jennifer.
I guess that's all I want to say.
Okay, we hear you. Go ahead, Matt Den.
Well, I first want to say that when Jennifer said she was from Newark, that I was afraid that it was my mother using an assumed name, because
apparently not.
She is your biggest. It was not my mother, but she is your biggest fan. And I mentioned to you before I came on that this, my being on your show for her, I think since my law school graduation, is probably the biggest.
I love
thing
your
that's
mother.
Happened.
Just so you know,
okay. I think that Attorney General Biden was very committed to dealing with the crime problem. And one thing that I can say is that, having inherited the staff that he hired, I have just been tremendously impressed. I've hired, I think, three people since I started. So the other 400 and some who are working for me are people that Attorney General Biden hired. And they're really top-notch people. So to the extent that I've been able to lay eyes on the results of what was going on there over the last 8 years, they've put some really outstanding people in place that are committed.
We're almost out of time here, but I have to say, it looks like all of our calls and almost all of our social media here has to do with violent crime in Delaware. So you got your work cut out for you.
I do.
Matt Den, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he is the new Attorney General of the state of Delaware. He was the Lieutenant Governor and also the Insurance Commissioner. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, how to download a podcast of the program, also how to find us on Twitter and follow us, leave a comment on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.